2. Opening the ancient, empty Camel cigarettes package, Virgil Ackerman said as he flattened its surfaces,
"Hits, cracks, taps, or pops? Which do you take, sweet scent?"
"Taps," Eric said. The old man peered at the marking stamped on the inside, glued bottom fold of the now two-dimensional package.
"It's cracks. I get to cork you on the arm 32 times.
He ritualistically tapped Eric on the shoulder, smiling gleefully, his natural style ivory teeth pale and full of animated luster.
"Far be it from me to injure you, doctor. After all, I might need a new liver any moment now. I had a bad few hours last night after I went to bed, and I think, but check me on this, it was due to toxemia once again. I felt loggy."
In the seat beside Virgil Ackerman, Dr. Eric Sweetscent said, "How late were you up, and what did you do?"
"Well, doctor, there was this girl."
Virgil grinned mischievously at Harvey, Jonas, Ralph, and Phyllis Ackerman, those members of the family who sat around him in his thin, tapered Interplan ship as it sped from Terra toward Wash 35 on Mars.
"Need I say more?"
His great-grandniece Phyllis said severely,
"Oh, Christ, you're too old. Your heart'll give out again, right in the middle. And then what'll she, whoever she is, think? It's undignified to die during you-know-what."
She eyed Virgil reprovingly. Virgil screeched,
"Then the dead man's control in my right fist, carried for such emergencies, would summon Dr. Sweetscent here, and he'd dash in and right there on the spot, without removing me, he'd take out that bad, collapsed old heart and stick in a brand new one, and I'd..."
He giggled, then patted away the saliva from his lower lip and chin with a folded linen handkerchief from his breastcoat pocket.
"I'd continue."
His paper-thin flesh glowed, and beneath it his bones, the outline of his skull, fine and clearly distinguishable, quivered with delight and the joy of tantalizing them. They had no entree into this world of his, the private life which he, because of his privileged position, enjoyed even now during the days of privation which the war had brought on.
"Mille traits,"
Harvey said sourly, quoting DuPont's libretto.
"But with you, you old cranknit, it's, however you say, 1,000,000,003 in Italian. I hope when I'm your age..."
"You won't ever be my age!"
Virgil chortled, his eyes dancing and flaming up with the vitality of enjoyment.
"Forget it, Harv! Forget it and go back to your fiscal records, you walking, droning on abacus! They won't find you dead in bed with a woman, they'll find you dead with a..."
Virgil searched his mind.
"With an inkwell!"
"Please," Phyllis said dryly, turning to look out at the stars and the black sky of tween space. Eric said to Virgil, "I'd like to ask you something about a pack of Lucky Strike Green. About 3 months ago..."
"Your wife loves me," Virgil said. "Yes, it was for me, doctor, a gift without strings. So ease your feverish mind. Kathy's not interested. Anyhow, it would cause trouble. Women I can get. Artifork surgeons, well..."
He reflected.
"Yes, when you think about it, I can get that too."
"Just as I told Eric earlier today," Jonas said. He winked at Eric, who stoically did not show any response.
"But I like Eric," Virgil continued. "He's a calm type. Oh, look at him right now. Sublimely reasonable, always the cerebral type, cool in every crisis. I've watched him work many times, Jonas, I ought to know. And willing to get up at any hour of the night, and that sort you don't see much."
"You pay him," Phyllis said shortly.
She was, as always, taciturn and withdrawn. Virgil's attractive great-grandniece, who sat on the corporation's board of directors, had a piercing, raptor-like quality, much like the old man's, but without his sly sense of the peculiar. To Phyllis, everything was business or dross. Eric reflected that had she come on to Himmel, there would be no more little carts wheeling about. In Phyllis's world, there was no room for the harmless. She reminded him a little of Kathy. And, like Kathy, she was reasonably sexy. She wore her hair in one long braided pigtail dyed a fashionable ultramarine, set off by autonomic rotating earrings, and this he did not especially enjoy, a nose ring, sign of nubility with the higher bourgeois circles. "What's the purpose of this conference?" Eric asked Virgil Ackerman. "Can we start discussing it now to save time?" He felt irritable.
"A pleasure trip," Virgil said. "Chance to get away from the gloomy biz we're in. We have a guest meeting us at Wash 35. He may already be there. He's got a blank check. I've opened my baby land to him. The first time I've let anybody but myself experience it freely."
"Who?" Harve demanded. "After all, technically Wash 35 is the property of the corporation, and we're on the board."
Jonas said acidly. "Virgil probably lost all his authentic Horrors of War flip cards to this person, so what else could he do but throw open the gates of the place to him?"
"I never flip with my Horrors of War cards or my FBI cards," Virgil said. "And by the way, I have a duplicate of the sinking of the Panay. Eaton Hambro, you know, the fathead who's board chairman of Manfrex Enterprises, gave it to me on my birthday. I thought everyone knew I had a complete file, but evidently not Hambro. No wonder Frenexi's boys are running his 6 factories for him these days."
"Tell us about Shirley Temple and the Littlest Rebel," Phyllis said in a bored tone, still looking out at the panorama of stars beyond the ship. "Tell us how she..."
"You've seen that."
Virgil sounded testy.
"Yes, but I never get tired of it," Phyllis said. "No matter how hard I try, I still can't find it anything but engrossing. Right down to the last miserable inch of film." She turned to Harve. "Your lighter?"
Rising from his seat, Eric walked to the lounge of the small ship, seated himself at the table, and picked up the drink list. His throat felt dry. The bickering that went on within the Ackerman clan always made him dully thirsty, as if he were in need of some reassuring fluid. Perhaps, he thought, a substitute for the primordial milk, the milk of life. "I deserve my own baby land, too," he thought half in jest, but only half. To everyone but Virgil Ackerman, the Washington, D.C. of 1935 was a waste of time, since only Virgil remembered the authentic city, the authentic time and place, the environment now so long passed away. In every detail, therefore, Wash 35 consisted of a painstakingly elaborate reconstruction of the specific limited universe of childhood which Virgil had known, constantly refined and improved in matters of authenticity by his antique procurer, Kathy Sweetscent, without really ever being in a genuine sense changed. It had coagulated, cleaved to the dead past, at least as far as the rest of the clan were concerned. But to Virgil, it of course sprouted life. There, he blossomed. He restored his flagging biochemical energy and then returned to the present, to the shared, current world, which he eminently understood and manipulated, but of which he did not psychologically feel himself a native. And his vast regressive babyland had caught on, become a fad. On lesser scales, other top industrialists and money boys, to speak in a brutal and frank way, war profiteers, had made life-size models of their childhood worlds, too. Virgil's now had ceased to be unique. None, of course, matched Virgil's in complexity and sheer authenticity. Fakes of antique items, not the actual surviving articles, had been strewn about in vulgar approximations of what had been the authentic reality. But in all fairness, it had to be realized, Eric reflected, No one possessed the money and economic know-how to underwrite this admittedly uniquely expensive and, beyond all others, imitations all, utterly impractical venture. This, in the midst of the dreadful war. But still, it was, after all, harmless, in its quaint sort of way. A bit, he reflected, like Bruce Himmel's peculiar activity with his many clanky little carts. It slaughtered no one. And this could hardly be said for the national effort, the jihad against the creatures from Proxima. On thinking of this, an unpleasant recollection entered his mind. On Terra at the UN capital city, Cheyenne, Wyoming, in addition to those in POW camps, there existed a herd of captured, defanged Reegs maintained on public exhibition by the Terran military establishment. Citizens could file past and gawk and ponder at length the meaning of these exoskeletoned beings with six extremities in all, capable of progressing linearly at a great rate on either two or four legs. The Reegs had no audible vocal apparatus. They communicated bee-wise by elaborate, dance-like weavings of their sensory stalks. With Terrans and Starmen, they employed a mechanical translation box, and through this the gawkers had an opportunity to question their humbled captives. Questions until recently had run to a monotonous, baiting uniformity. But now a new interrogation had begun by subtle stages to put in its very ominous appearance, ominous at least from the standpoint of the establishment. In view of this inquiry, the exhibit had abruptly terminated, and for an indefinite time. How can we come to a rapprochement? The Reegs, oddly, had an answer. It amounted to live and let live. Expansion by Terrans into the Proxima system would cease. The Reegs would not. And actually had not in the past invest the Sol system. But as to Lilistar, the Reegs had no answer there because they had developed none for themselves. The Starmen had been their enemies for centuries, and it was too late for anyone to give or take any advice on this subject. And anyhow, Star advisors had already managed to take up residence on Terra for the performance of security functions, as if a four-armed, ant-like organism 6 feet high could pass unnoticed on a New York street. The presence of Star advisors, however, easily passed unnoticed. The Starmen were phycomycetous mentally, but morphologically they could not be distinguished from Terrans. There was a good reason for this. In Mousterian times, a flotilla from Lilistar's Alpha Centaurus Empire had migrated to the Sol system, had colonized Earth and to some extent Mars. A fracas with deadly overtones had broken out between settlers of the two worlds, and a long, degenerating war had followed, the upshot of which had been the decline of both subcultures to acute and dreary barbarism. Due to climatic faults, the Mars colony had at last died out entirely. The Terran, however, had groped its way up through historical ages and at last back to civilization. Cut off from Alpha by the Lilistar-Reeg conflict, the Terran colony had again become planet-wide, elaborated, bountiful, had advanced to the stage of launching first an orbiting satellite and then an unmanned ship to Luna, and at last a manned ship, and was, as a chef d'oeuvre, able once more to contact its system of origin. The surprise, of course, had been vast on both sides. "Cat got your tongue?" Phyllis Ackerman said to Eric, seating herself beside him in the cramped lounge. She smiled, an effort which transfigured her thin, delicately cut face. She looked for a moment appealingly pretty. "Order me a drink, too, so I can face the world of Bolo Bats and Jean Harlow and Baron von Richthofen and Joe Lewis and... what the hell is it?" She searched her memory, eyes squeezed shut. "I've blocked it out of my mind. Oh, yes, Tom Mix and his Ralston straight shooters with the Wrangler, that wretched Wrangler, and that cereal, and those eternal goddamn box tops. You know what we're in for, don't you? Another session with Orphan Annie and her Lil Decoder badge? We'll have to listen to ads for Ovaltine, and then those numbers read out for us to take down and decode to find out what Annie does on Monday. God." She bent to reach for her drink, and he could not resist peering with near-professional interest as the top of her dress gave way to show the natural line of her small, articulated, pale breasts. Put by this spectacle in a reasonably good mood, Eric said playfully but cautiously, "One day we'll jot down the numbers the fake announcer gives over the fake radio, decode them with the Orphan Annie decoder badge, and..." The message will say, he thought glumly, "Make a separate peace with the Reegs at once." "I know," Phyllis said, and thereupon finished for him. "It's hopeless, Earthman. Give up now. This is the monarch of the Reegs speaking. Looky here, y'all. I've infiltrated radio station WMAL in Washington, D.C., and I'm going to destroy you." She somberly drank from her tall-stemmed glass. "And in addition, the Ovaltine you've been drinking..." I wasn't going to say precisely that, but she had come awfully darn close. Nettled, Eric said, "Like the rest of your family, you've got a gene that requires you to interrupt before a non-blooder."
"A what?"
"That's what we call you," he said grimly, "you Ackerman."
"Go ahead then, Doctor."
Her gray eyes lit with amusement.
"Say your tiny say."
Eric said, "Never mind. Who's the guest?" The great pale eyes of the woman had never seemed so large, so composed. They dominated and commanded with their utter inner universe of certitude, of tranquility created by absolute, unchanging knowledge of all that deserved to be known.
"Suppose we wait and see."
And then, not yet affecting the changelessness of her eyes, her lips began to dance with a wicked, teasing playfulness. A moment later, a new and different spark ignited within her eyes, and thereupon the expression of her entire face underwent a total change.
"The door,"
she said wickedly, her eyes gleaming and intense, her mouth twitching in a mirth-ridden giggle almost that of an adolescent girl.
"Flies open, and there stands a silent delegate from Proxima."
Ah, what a sight.
A bloated, greasy enemy Reeg. Secretly and incredibly because of Phrenexy's snooping secret police, a Reeg here officially to negotiate for a...
She broke off, and then at last, in a low monotone, finished,
"A separate peace between us and them."
With a dark and moody expression, her eyes no longer lit by any spark whatsoever, she listlessly finished her drink.
"Yes, that'll be the day. How well I can picture it. Old Virgil sits in, beaming and cackling as usual, and sees his war contracts, every fnugging last one of them, slither down the drain, back to fake mink, back to the backcrap days, when the whole factory stank to high heaven."
She laughed shortly, a brisk bark of derision.
"Any minute now, Doctor." "Oh, sure."
"Phrenexy's cops," Eric said, sharing her mood, "as you pointed out yourself, would swoop down on Wash 35 so dolb fast."
"I know, it's a fantasy, a wish fulfillment dream, born out of hopeless longing. So it hardly matters whether Virgil would decide to mastermind and try to carry off such an encounter or not, does it? Because it couldn't be done successfully in a million light years. It could be tried, but not done."
"Too bad," Eric said, half to himself, deep in thought.
"Traitor? You want to be popped into the slave labor pool?"
Eric, after pondering, said cautiously,
"I want..." "You don't know what you want, sweet scent. Every man involved in an unhappy marriage loses the metabiological capacity to know what he does want. It's been taken away from him. You're a smelly little shell, trying to do the correct thing, but never quite making it because your miserable little long-suffering heart isn't in it. Look at you now. You've managed to squirm away from me."
"Have not?"
"So we're no longer touching physically, especially thigh-wise. Oh, perish thigh-wise from the universe. But it is hard, is it not, to do it? To squirm away in such close quarters? Here in the lounge? And yet you've managed to do it, haven't you?"
To change the subject, Eric said, "I heard on TV last night that the quatrologist with the funny beard, that Professor Wald, is back from..."
"No, He's not Virgil's guest.
Marm Hastings, then? That Taoist spellbinding nut and crank and fool? You manufacturing a joke, sweet scent, is that it? You suppose Virgil would tolerate a marginal fake that... She made an obscene upward jerking gesture with her thumb, at the same time grinning in a show of her white, clean, and very impressive clear teeth.
Maybe, she said, it's Ian Norse.
Who's he? He had heard the name. It had a vaguely familiar sound to it, and he knew that in asking her he was making a tactical error. Still, he did it. This, if anything, was his weakness in regard to women. He led where they followed, sometimes. But more than once, especially at critical times in his life, in the major junctions, he followed guilelessly where they led. Phyllis sighed.
Ian's firm makes all those shiny, sterile, new, very expensive artificial organs you cleverly graft into rich dying people. You mean, Doctor, you're not clear as to whom you're indebted?
I know, Eric said irritably, feeling chagrin. With everything else on my mind, I forgot momentarily, that's all.
Maybe it's a composer, as in the days of Kennedy. Maybe it's Pablo Casals. God, he would be old. Maybe it's Beethoven.
She pretended to ponder.
By God, I do think he said something about that. Ludwig von somebody. Well, is there a Ludwig von somebody else other than...
Christ! Eric said angrily, weary of being teased. Stop it!
Don't pull rank. You're not so great. Keeping one creepy old man alive century after century...
She giggled her low, sweet, and very intimate warm giggle of delighted mirth. Eric said, with as much dignity as he could manage, I also maintain TF&D's entire workforce of 80,000 key individuals, and as a matter of fact, I can't do that from Mars, so I resent all this. I resent it very much. You included, he thought bitterly to himself.
What a ratio, Phyllis said. One Artiforg surgeon to 80,000 patients. 80,001. But you have your team of robots to help you. Perhaps they can make do while you're absent.
A robot isn't it that stinks, he said, paraphrasing T.S. Eliot.
And an Artiforg surgeon, Phyllis said, isn't it that grovels.
He glowered at her. She sipped her drink and showed no contrition. He could not get to her. She simply had too much psychic strength for him. The Omphalos of Wash 35, a five-story brick apartment building where Virgil had lived as a boy, contained a truly modern apartment of their year 2055, with every detail of convenience which Virgil could obtain during these war years. Several blocks away lay Connecticut Avenue, and along it, stores which Virgil remembered. Here was Gamage's, a shop at which Virgil had bought tip-top comics and penny candy. Next to it, Eric made out the familiar shape of People's Drugstore. The old man during his childhood had bought a cigarette lighter here once and chemicals for his Gilbert No. 5 glass-blowing and chemistry set.
What's the Uptown Theater showing this week?
Harv Ackerman murmured as their ship coasted along Connecticut Avenue so that Virgil could review these treasured sights. He peered. It was Jean Harlow in Hell's Angels, which all of them had seen at least twice. Harv groaned.
But don't forget that lovely scene, Phyllis reminded him, where Harlow says, I think I'll go slip into something more comfortable. And then when she returns,
I know, Harv said irritably. Okay, that I like.
The ship taxied from Connecticut Avenue onto Macomb Street, and soon was parking before 3039 with its black wrought iron fence and tiny lawn. When the hatch slid back, however, Eric smelled not the city air of a long-gone Terran capital, but the bitterly thin and cold atmosphere of Mars. He could hardly get his lungs full of it, and he stood gasping, feeling disoriented and sick.
I'll have to goose them about the air machinery,
Virgil complained as he descended the ramp to the sidewalk, assisted by Jonas and Harv. It did not seem to bother him, however. He spryly hiked toward the doorway of the apartment building. Robots in the shape of small boys hopped to their feet, and one of them yelled authentically,
"Hey, Verge, where you been?"
"Had to do an errand for my mother,"
Virgil cackled, his face shining with delight.
"How are you, Earl? Hey, I got some good Chinese stamps my dad gave me. He got them at his office. There's duplicates. I'll trade you."
He fished in his pocket, halting on the porch of the building.
"Hey, you know what I have?"
a second robot child shrilled.
"Some dry ice. I let Bob Rougie use my flexi for it. You can hold it if you want."
"I'll trade you a big little book for it,"
Virgil said as he produced his key and unlocked the front door of the building.
"How about Buck Rogers and the Doom Comet? That's real keen."
As the rest of the party descended from the ship, Phyllis said to Eric,
"Offer the children a mint condition 1952 Marilyn Monroe nude calendar and see what they'll give you for it. At least half a popsicle."
As the apartment house door swung aside, a TF&D guard belatedly appeared.
"Oh, Mr. Ackerman, I didn't realize you'd arrived."
The guard ushered them into the dark, carpeted hall.
"Is he here yet?"
Virgil asked with sudden apparent tension.
"Yes, sir, in the apt resting. He's asked not to be disturbed for several hours."
The guard, too, seemed nervous. Halting, Virgil said,
"How large is his party?"
"Just himself, an aide, and two Secret Service men."
"Who's for a glass of ice-cold Kool-Aid?"
Virgil said reflexively over his shoulder as he led the way.
"Me, me,"
Phyllis said, mimicking Virgil's enthusiastic tone.
"I want imitation fruit raspberry lime. What about you, Eric? How about gin bourbon lime or cherry scotch vodka? Or didn't they sell those flavors back in 1935?
To Eric, Harv said,
"I'd like a place to lie down and rest myself. This Martian air makes me weak as a kitten."
His face had become mottled and ill-looking.
"Why doesn't he build a dome? Keep real air in here."
"Maybe," Eric pointed out, "there's a purpose in this. Prevents him from retiring here for good. Makes him leave after a short while." Coming up to them, Jonas said,
"Personally, I enjoy coming to this anachronistic place, Harv. It's a fnugging museum."
To Eric, he said,
"In all fairness, your wife does a superb job of providing artifacts for this period."
"Listen to that. What's it called? That radio playing in that apt?"
Dutifully, they listened. It was Betty and Bob, the ancient soap opera, emanating from the long-departed past. And even Eric found himself impressed. The voices seemed alive and totally real. They were here now, not mere echoes of themselves. How Kathy had achieved this, he didn't know.
Steve, the huge and handsome, masculine Negro janitor of the building, or rather his robot simulacrum, appeared then, smoking his pipe and nodding cordially to them all.
"Morning, Doctor. Little nip of cold we having these days. Kids be getting their sled out soonly. My own boy, Georgie, he's saving for a sled, he say little while ago to me."
"I'll chip in a 1934 dollar, Ralph Ackerman said, reaching for his wallet.
In a sotto voce aside to Eric, he said,
"Or does old Papa Virgil have it that the colored kid isn't entitled to a sled?"
"That no never mind, Mr. Ackerman," Steve assured him. "Georgie, he earned, he sled. He not want tips, but real and true pay."
The dignified dark robot moved off then and was gone.
"Damn convincing," Harv said presently.
"Really is,"
Jonas agreed. He shivered.
"God, to think that the actual man's been dead a century? It's distinctly hard to keep in mind that we're on Mars, not even on Earth in our own time.
I don't like it. I like things to appear what they really are."
A thought came to Eric.
"Do you object to a stereotape of a symphony played back in the evening when you're at home in your apt?"
"No,"
Jonas said.
"But that's totally different."
"It's not," Eric disagreed. "The orchestra isn't there. The original sound has departed. The hall in which it was recorded is now silent. All you possess is 1,200 feet of iron oxide tape that's been magnetized in a specific pattern. It's an illusion, just like this. Only this is complete."
QED, he thought, and walked on then, toward the stairs.
We live with illusion daily, he reflected. When the first bard rattled off the first epic of a sometime battle, illusion entered our lives. The Iliad is as much a fake as those robot children trading postage stamps on the porch of the building. Humans have always striven to retain the past, to keep it convincing. There's nothing wicked in that. Without it, we have no continuity. We have only the moment. And deprived of the past, the moment, the present, has little meaning, if any. Maybe, he pondered as he ascended the stairs, that's my problem with Kathy. I can't remember our combined past, can't recall the days when we voluntarily lived with each other. Now it's become an involuntary arrangement, derived God knows how from the past. And neither of us understands it. Neither of us can puzzle out its meaning or its motivating mechanism. With a better memory, we could turn it back into something we could fathom. He thought, maybe this is the first sign of old age making its dread appearance. And for me, at 34. Phyllis, halting on the stair, waiting for him, said, have an affair with me, doctor. Inwardly, he quailed, felt hot, felt terror, felt excitement, felt hope, felt hopelessness, felt guilt, felt eagerness. He said, you have the most perfect teeth known to man. Answer. He tried to think of an answer. Could words respond to this? But this had come in the form of words, had it not? And be roasted into a cinder by Kathy, who sees everything that goes on? He felt the woman staring at him, staring and staring with her huge, star-fixed eyes. He said, not too cleverly, and felt miserable and small, and exactly precisely right to the last jot and tittle what he ought not to be. Phyllis said, but you need it. He said, wilting under this unwanted, undeserved female psychiatric examination of his evil inner soul. She had it, his soul, and she was turning it over and over on her tongue. God damn her. She had figured it out. She spoke the truth. He hated her. He longed to go to bed with her. And of course she knew, saw on his face all this, saw it with her accursed huge eyes, eyes which no mortal woman ought to possess. You're going to perish without it, Phyllis said, without true, spontaneous, relaxed, physical, sheer. One chance, he said hoarsely, in a billion, of getting away with it. He managed then actually to laugh. In fact, our standing here right now on these damn stairs is folly. But what the... Do you care? He started on then, actually past her, continued on up to the second floor. What do you have to lose? He thought. It's me. I'd be the one. You can handle Kathy just as easily as you can yank me around at the end of that line you keep paying out and reeling back. The door of Virgil's private modern apt stood open. Virgil had gone inside. The balance of the party straggled after him, the Blood Clan first, of course, then the mere titled officers of the firm. Eric entered and saw Virgil's guest. The guest, the man they had come here to see, reclining, his face empty and slack, lips bulging dark purple and irregular, eyes fixed absently on nothing, was Gino Molinari, supreme elected leader of Terra's unified planetary culture and the supreme commander of its armed forces in the war against the Riegs. His fly was unbuttoned.